Good morning. It is good to be back in your pulpit again. I was here in 1998 when you ordained your intern, Kate Walker, into the Unitarian Universalist ministry. How many of you were here then? Yes. Kate and I were classmates at Starkey School in Berkeley. And when I was driving across the country to begin my internship south of Boston, Kate was beginning hers here. And I stopped by across my cross-country drive, and she took me up into the high country on a hike to find Columbine. Now, the blue Columbine that is your state flower is so called because Columba is Latin, the dove. Can you see the dove in the flower? It's a stretch. In the spring of my first year of seminary, I placed a pot of Columbine on the windowsill of my dorm room for insight and for inspiration. Its pale pink blossom flying high on a singular stem kept me mindful that in ancient times, the image of a dove being born from the mouth of a dolphin, Delphos, womb, symbolized woman's rebirth journey. For a woman's spiritual task is to give birth to her whole self out of her ego self. Then, as I prepared to go home that summer to close out my old life there, I took the pot to the gardener at Starking School and I asked her to plant it somewhere. She did, right beneath an enormous tree in front of school. All that second seminary year, as I struggled to live in the liminal space between the familiar security of the old life and the as yet incomprehensible new life that I was trying to move into, I looked forward to that Columbine's reappearance in the spring. But when it finally bloomed, it was small, close to the ground, and it was red with a yellow center. Stunned, I sought out the gardener. What happened to my gorgeous pink Columbine? She looked at it and declared, it reverted to its original self. All nursery-grown Columbine are hybrids, cultivated to be showy. This one simply became its authentic self again. Now that was a perfect metaphor for becoming a minister and beginning a new life from an authentic self. So when Kate invited me to participate in her ordination into ministry, I was delighted to find you had a Columbine on your cover of service. I'm sure you remember that. I even used the Columbine as an image in my charge to you as your congregation. I was even wearing the same Columbine-covered stole. So now I bring you another charge this morning. Forgive me, but the Columbine is insisting upon it. For you see, these summers, when I hike up into the high country to commune with them, I find that your state flower is fading and thinning, exactly as predicted by a Berkeley researcher who did his summer field work in your mountains. Over several years, he observed what happened when he simulated the conditions of global warming in an alpine meadow. Sage crept up the slope and replaced the Columbine. I can't stand that. And I can't let that stand. And so here I make my stand. In part two this morning, I will describe to you what I have done and what you can do. Meanwhile, consider this. My path into climate awareness clearly parallels our first source, the direct experience of that transcendent mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold life. Your journey into climate awareness may be predicated on another source. For instance, Another approach might be through the fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And the sixth source, humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against the idolatries of the mind and spirit. So to share his journey into climate awareness through that lens, here is our scientist friend, Jonathan Orms.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
It was 1957. Excuse me, is this working?
Yes.
It was 1957. I just started college, and that fall, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, frightening the nation. My patriotic duty was to study physics and contribute to the nation's need for technical talent. I went to graduate school in physics. I learned about space and invisible energetic particles that are dangerous for humans. Then I found Jen and got married. We both love nature. I got a job at NASA and started my research in the late 60s. I didn't support the Vietnam War. The national leaders with whom I agreed were being shot. I started to question, what was the value of my research to the human condition? It didn't feed the hungry, provide jobs for the unemployed, or stop inhumanity to man or woman. The research itself was exhilarating. New satellites were revealing secrets on a regular basis. Growth of population and the economy was phenomenal, driven by inexpensive energy. Astronauts landed on the moon and took pictures of Earth from space. My awareness of the Earth as a whole grew as images began to pour in. By the 1990s, I became privy to some of the earliest warnings about global warming. Jim Hansen stood nearby and gave the first dire warning I heard. Carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases were going to have a serious impact on our climate. I heard briefings on the probable health impacts. I became friends with scientists who were studying these effects. When I retired, I resolved that I had to become directly involved in the problem of climate change. I listened to those who didn't accept the growing consensus. A good scientist does not accept without evidence. I spent the next few years studying and learning and became convinced. I learned about peak oil, the exponential growth of our population, and the relationship between energy use and affluence. I got depressed. I worried that the confluence of problems was insurmountable. I eventually learned that the only escape from an emotional backwater is by doing something. I started giving talks and teaching about the climate. I have the advantage of training to understand the effect of things I cannot see or experience directly. Things like carbon dioxide, temperature, energy, and stuff like that. So what now? I have come to see no point in butting heads with deniers and those who are indifferent. Most of those who want to know about climate change already know. Of course, I am delighted to talk with those who are open-minded and willing to listen and learn. I have realized that this problem is disproportionately caused by the affluent and falls most heavily on the poor and on other species. I believe we scientists are morally obligated to take the lead in solving this problem. I have learned that the problem is serious, but fixable. While the political inaction is frustrating, it's clear lots of people are involved and something is being done. It is not helpful to think it's hopeless. As I approach the twilight of life, I may not have many years left to better align my actions with my values. So So now I am trying to figure out how to make this alignment work in practice. I am seeking association with those who are convinced and are already doing something, and I am finding that there are a lot of them and that I like them a lot. I am doing something and I feel great.
Okay, now it's your turn. So for the next few moments, I invite you to ponder the words of America the Beautiful as you listen to it. As it evokes the spacious skies and waves of grain and majestic mountains and shining seas, which of these speaks especially unto you? And how do you feel about the oil spills along our coasts, the tops of our mountains being blasted off for coal, and the hundreds of thousands of natural gas wells that preside over the plains, all of which are contributing to the release of CO2 into the spacious skies so that now our global temperature contains 400 parts per million, condition not seen since the time of the dinosaurs and the last mass extinction. In fact, we the people are already bringing about the sixth great extinction. How does that reality line up with our Unitarian Universalist principle that urges respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part? Houston, we have a problem. Spaceship Earth seems to be self-destructing. Deserts are expanding, ice caps are receding, sea levels are rising, and the CO2 in the atmosphere is reaching levels not seen since the time of the dinosaurs. And all this seems to be at the hand of its humans, inhabitants. Can, will, things turn around before it's too late? Street wisdom says no. The situation will get so bad that Earth will simply shuck us off as a failed experiment and go sailing on without us. After all, we people are so entrenched in our consumerist lifestyles that we consistently refuse to believe that there's even a problem, and then we don't have to do anything about it. And meanwhile, the fossil fuel industry, upon which our economy is based, is determined to dig up, frack for, drill down to, and burn every last ounce of CO2, releasing coal, oil, and natural gas in order to max out its bottom line. Plus, it has bought off the politicians who could stop this madness or slow things down. At least that's the narrative we are being told. But there is another story unfolding. For instance, here in America, where ordinary people have always taken it upon themselves to deal with seemingly intractable situations, we are taking action. How can we not? After all, the very spirit of America has always been about standing up, not standing down or standing aside. From Bunker Hill to Lexington Green, from Concord Bridge to Boston Harbor, where the original Tea Party took place, we the people face and embrace our challenges head on. This trajectory has continued throughout our history, and I particularly think of the life of Thomas Stark King. He was a Universalist minister in Boston, who hung with the Transcendentalists, by the way, and he was called to serve the Unitarian Society of San Francisco in 1860. Our seminary in Berkeley is named after him. Through his anti-slavery sermons and lectures, he is credited with keeping California in the Union during the Civil War. And thus, his was one of two statues from California that graced Statuary Hall in the nation's capital, until it was recently replaced by that of Ronald Reagan. Stark King was also an amateur naturalist whose love for the outdoors helped convince President Lincoln to federally preserve and protect California's giant redwoods. For when you spend time in nature and come to know it as something beyond your small ego self, you must fight for its well-being. And that is why I'm here this morning on behalf of your Colorado Columbine that is being impacted by climate change. I vividly recall the insight that I had while doing an interim ministry year in the Unitarian Church in Charleston, South Carolina. Driving beneath a billboard advertising a newly opened slave museum, I looked up at the image of a dark-skinned man in chains, and it hit me. This is exactly what we are doing to the earth, enslaving it for our pleasure, power, profit. And in the process, we are changing the climate and contributing to the next mass extinction, all in the name of progress and for the sake of jobs. Yet our English word ecology and economy both come from that singular root ekos, which is Greek for home. So I submit unto you that any economic activity that threatens our ecosystems on our home planet is insane, immoral, and ought to be deemed illegal. For just as the cotton-based economy of the Civil War era did not justify slavery, the fossil fuel-based economy of today does not justify enslaving the living earth. Yes, Houston, we have a problem, and we're on it. Ordinary people, non-corporate persons, we are taking action. We are banning fracking. We are blocking pipelines. We are lobbying Congress for a carbon tax. We are divesting our personal and professional portfolios from fossil fuels and demanding that our churches and our colleges do likewise. And yes, we are changing our light bulbs. But we are also changing our life ways. We are weaning ourselves off fossil fuel addiction and insisting on renewable, non-polluting ways to empower our lifestyle. By installing rooftop solar to power our homes and our electric cars, sinking geothermal loops for heating and cooling, growing and eating local organic foods, driving fuel-efficient cars, biking. In short, we are taking responsibility for our planet-destroying consumerist habits. Now, you can find information on many of these people-powered efforts at the Green First kiosk after the service this morning, where you can also sign up to join us on August 15th for a workshop that will help you plan your personalized response to climate change. Do you doubt that we can make any difference? Let's try something, shall we? How many people in this room were involved in the civil rights movement back in the 1960s? How many people were involved with the women's movement in the 1970s? How many were involved in any aspect of the peace movement, especially in the 1980s when we lobbied and got at the U.S. Institute of Peace in hopes of eventually establishing a cabinet-level Department of Peace? How many were involved with that? And how many people have been involved with gay rights issues down through the years? None of the advances in any of these areas happened by themselves, you know. We the people made them happen. And now we are facing the mother of all human crises. Please be assured, from young people to elders, indigenous tribes to people of faith, from the Parliament of World Religions to our own Unitarian Universalist Association, we are joining forces against the powers and principalities that seem bound and determined to destroy the planet. And if you are wondering why the Catholic politicians are so pissed at the Pope over his sweeping encyclical on the climate, here's why. In it, the Pope makes clear that climate change is caused by people. and that people must take responsibility for it. This completely demolishes the argument frequently used on the floor of the United States Congress that goes something like this. God would never allow humans to destroy the planet. How arrogant of us to think that we are that powerful. We aren't. The whole world is in God's hands. Translation: it's not our problem, and so we're not going to do anything about it. But let's be clear about this. We Americans are responsible for 5 times more CO2 emissions per person than the Chinese, 3 times more than the Europeans, and on and on. And now the Pope has joined the existing movement to recognize that there is indeed a problem and that it is human caused, and it can only be fixed when we accept responsibility for addressing it. I highly, highly encourage you to download and read his encyclical. But if you do not have the time for the entire 184 pages, I have pulled out 7 excerpts for you to reflect on during the coming week. As you live into questions about climate change, it's in your order of service. You're welcome. We make no mistake. We the people are on the move. We will step up. We will accept our responsibility for the problem, and we will work to resolve it. Our national epic demands it. Our natural landscapes command it. May it be so. Blessed be. And someone say amen.
Amen.